Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Collier Fourie decided to become a winemaker while working in a restaurant in Scotland, of all places, far from her native South Africa. It was a smart move, as she's now regarded as one of the most innovative talents in the Cape. Listen to us chat about empowerment, Wellington, old vine Chenin Blanc, fair trade certification, and the community that makes Bosman Family Vineyards such a special place to work. Hi, Collier, how are you?
Oh, Tim, fantastic, thanks.
And where are you at the moment? In South Africa, I assume?
Yes, South Africa, at the winery in Wellington, close to Cape Town. Yes, at 6 o'clock in the evening.
We're working hard on a Sunday.
Yeah, perfect. You know what? I had to make a decision, and I just knew that having the kids and two dogs at home might come in not handy. So this is the best place to do this.
And vintage is long over. How's it looking this year?
Yes, we waited for vintage quite a long time. And then we also had a very interesting vintage with, taking in the whites, waiting for the reds to come in. But it was well worth it. I think every time we go through the cellar and taste a little bit more, we're just so excited and feeling really positive about what's in tank.
So 21 was a late vintage, 20 was an early vintage, wasn't it, throughout the new world, really?
Yes. And I think it's one of those moments where you really realize all over again that you're in agriculture and you're, open to nature, and that there's nothing that's going to get you to that seaside house for a holiday. You know, it is nature. It is what it is. And it's so wonderfully satisfying, isn't it?
Yeah, if you can't go, you can't go.
You can't.
Listen, you were brought up nowhere near the seaside. You were brought up in the Free State, weren't you?
Yes.
Which is sort of maize and cattle country rather than wine country. I mean, were your parents wine drinkers? Have you had a background in wine?
The background in wine comes from my father's side. So he grew up in a small place called Carcamas, which is in the Northern Cape, next to the Orange River. And my grandfather actually produced a small little bit of grapes that went into the cooperative cellar. It was a small holding, definitely not a commercial, very tiny operation where everybody in the family had to harvest. My grandmother had little mittens because of that sun that they have in the Northern Cape, and a big hat. I remember her, being 80 and having this beautiful porcelain skin, because obviously she looked after herself and my grandfather didn't. So quite freckly, and you could see that harvesting all of those years had a big impact on his life. But the family story starts there. I think the love for wine and the love for grapes. My father ventured into finance, but as children, Sundays, we all had our own little crystal glass and we would have our little bit of wine. And my father would say, look, smell, taste, discuss. So it was brilliant.
Very good advice still to this day, I think.
Yes. And I think it became this thing where it awakened so many thoughts. How could something made of fruit, give you all of these fantastic attributes which weren't like fruit at all? So the interest was definitely, started around those dinner tables.
Yeah, it was there. I mean, I read somewhere that you did a year abroad. You worked overseas, didn't you, in Scotland, and you worked into restaurants and pubs and things. And that was what really made you decide to become a winemaker, which made you maybe the first person in history who's been up in Scotland and decided to go into the wine business. I thought you might have become a distiller or something like that.
Yes, but it just shows you how special Scotland is. I must say it had such a tremendous effect on my life. It basically was the knowledge of wanting to do something in science. So I was enrolled for medicine. My father and my mom was really worried about that. They knew me too well, I'm sure. And then in the end, whilst being in Scotland, being in this wonderful environment, working with people, working in the end, with people who loved wine, it just switched on the fact that I could do something a little bit more social, a little bit more agricultural, with this background of my family to some extent as well, and loving nature, loving people, that I started dreaming about vineyards in Scotland. It's quite sad because, yes, I did visit.
Well, they're warmer than most of Scotland, let's face it.
Yes, but I think the long and the short is that, you get inspired by different things in different places, but dreaming about the Cape Winelands there was wonderful, knowing that I was coming back to South Africa with a much clearer idea of what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and then you studied, as many people did, at Stellenbosch University. I just wondered, was it an inspiring place to study? I mean, who were your contemporaries at the time?
It was inspiring. You can imagine, so it was this whole culture shock coming from Bloemfontein in the Free State, very flat. I mean, the highest thing is a little hill called Navel Hill. But, I mean, it's not half the size of any of these beautiful, majestic mountains here in the Cape.
It's Navel with an N-A-V-A-L rather than N-A-V-E-L, is it right?
That's it. And, yes, and then going to Europe, coming back, and then being immersed in wine culture in Stellenbosch. It was visually absolutely fantastic. Contemporaries there, obviously, it's not just places which are inspiring, it's people as well. Many of my contemporaries still fond friends. I think if you think about Warren Ellis, we also love the fact that his father actually came in a few times and gave us some good advice. Carla Hawkins from Testolonga, Wim Tritter, who's now at Meerlis, the fantastic gentleman, which is Luca Quinnigan from Glen Ellie, Nsiki Payela was in my class as well. I think, it's such a wonderful, diverse group of people, and also quite a lot of our study friends who didn't join the ranks of winemakers, but our industry, either as being in marketing or in supply. So wonderful to always see them in the industry.
So, you've got friends still who are winemakers. You also, your husband is a winemaker as well, Ventus.
Yes.
I just wonder, do you critique each other's wines? Do you sit there over supper and say, oh, you could have done that better? Oh, I really like that. That's a fantastic vintage. How does it work?
You know what? My husband was basically the person who practically taught me how to make wine. As a student at Stellenbosch, you need to do a practical harvest. At that time, Bertus was really getting to grips with a thing we call coffee pinotage. And I wanted to know what it was all about. I was quite studious, and I was really interested in this technique and the science behind it. So Bertus is quite the scientist, to be honest. Went and did a harvest at Dimmerfontein, and then lo and behold, my mom asked me what I thought about this winemaker. And I said, you know what, Mom, I don't actually like this guy. And then not liking him actually referred to the point or the fact that he's such a passionate guy that, passionate people are sometimes hard to be around, especially when they're doing the thing that they're most passionate about. So, that it was quite something watching him that first year. But I also said to my mom, so yes, this, it's a tough harvest, but I think I'm going to marry him. And at the end of that harvest, we were married, and that's
wow.
Been some 19 years. So I think, we know how to be close to each other and to talk about wines. And I mean, as much as the wines that I've been making has been my wines, it's wines that he's also been on a journey with. And I really value his, his inputs and how he thinks about it, because he's also spent a lot of time around them. So no, it's been great.
Yeah. I mean, before you went to Bosman, where you are now, and you have been since 2007, you were a consultant for a bit, weren't you? For a year or so, you worked with other wineries. I just wonder, what does that teach you, consulting to a number of clients?
Well, something that I think is valuable from that time is actually knowing, customer care or looking after different people's interests. I find that every day in my day-to-day work in any way, we've got all of these fantastic customers and, giving each of them the amount of time and the due time that they think that they're, wanting from you, that takes a little bit of fancy footwork, but it's really important. It also taught me that your wine and your wine story is so special and unique, and that's the thing that you take forward, because all of these people that I was consulting for was from Wellington. And I think maybe that was also how I learned the beautiful diversity from this little town, you know, and what is going on here, and from different perspectives, got to know it well and knew that I really loved it.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about Wellington more in a minute because I think it's a very interesting and up-and-coming area in many ways. Just tell us about, you know, you arrived at Bosman, you've been there since 2007, so long-term winemaker now. What's it like working with a family business that's been there for eight generations? I mean, that's a pretty well-established farm, isn't it?
Yes, it's daunting and brilliant. I think daunting in knowing that what has been here for a long time. It's absolutely fabulous. But the other thing is that it's very dynamic. You could imagine that a family does not grow in business if there isn't this beautiful long-term vision, almost thinking what do we want to be in 40 years time, instead of thinking about what are we doing tomorrow. So switching into a long-term vision, switching into a family who also has a huge effect on community, I think that's the daunting part, knowing that in some way community is what we're busy with here. Has been really the journey of a lifetime. I think a lot of people ask, why do you stay somewhere? I mean, I've practically been in the same role for a very, very long time. But I think the beauty of it is that in any 12-month cycle, I've never done exactly the same things. There's always been something else, something new, something that we're aiming for, which has been really fantastic.
And presumably the fact that they own the farm means they haven't got worries about debts. I mean, they've got other worries, presumably about, you know, the community, and because the community very much depends on them to a degree, doesn't it?
Yes.
But they don't actually owe the bank any money.
Yes, I think that, well, that being said, obviously, if you're growing your business, you do sometimes owe the bank a little bit of money, right? But I think what, in terms of winemaking, it has given me is the opportunity to get to know little places and nooks and crannies and vineyards which have been planted there, and also to be part of a long-term planning system where, if we're thinking about our customers and thinking about, you know, what Wellington does best, that we're able to have the foresight to plant it and to execute it. So there's this lovely continuity which I really enjoy about it.
Yeah, and I think the best winemakers very often have a long-term association with a set of vineyards or even a one company. It can be their own company, of course, but, you know, I think, as you said, you get to know the grapes, don't you?
Yes, and I think that's where it all starts. And at the core of it, having this knowledge and learning. I mean, can't imagine myself actually thinking about the wine industry and the business and nature is so fickle almost. But if you have that set of things that you have every year that you know, that you know, that actually helps a bit.
Yeah. I mean, you're known as a grape innovator, certainly in terms of the grape varieties that you use. I mean, what have been the biggest innovations that you've brought to the business? Have you been able to put your own stamp on it?
I'm going to be honest that, you know, that was maybe the question that I thought about which troubled me most. But luckily, I can say that in 2007, when we restarted this family dream of making wine, so just for interest's sake, so a 260-year-old cellar, eight-generation wine family, the family stopped making wine in the cellar in the 50s because this was this beautiful moment in time where technology hit South Africa. So Günther Brötzel came back, you know, from his studies. He said, guys, we need to do fermentation, but we need to do it's in cooled tanks and with temperature control. So there was innovation. And then at that point, the family needed to focus on either, you know, modernizing the cellar or focusing on a booming viticultural industry, which is the nursery. And at that point, they chose nursery. Cellar was mothballed. And only in 2007, the family then restarted making wine in the cellar. So to be quite honest, I'm quite happy that I didn't have to come and change things. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate to grow with this brand and to be able to implement things that fit our company and that fit our strategy. But I would hope that if people do remember me one day for some inputs that I have given, that it was in terms of mentorship and in terms of paying it forward, and, you know, for people to be able to grow within our business and to learn things in our business and to excel. So I'm hoping that that might be my biggest innovation, which isn't an innovation, but...
Well, it is. It's a huge innovation. You know, it's very important, I think. I mean, you've talked about the nursery, which means you've got access to all these different grape varieties. I think 50 in all at the last count. Do you have a favourite? I mean, is it Chenin? I don't know. Is it Sanceau? Or do you prefer blends? I mean, you make some fantastic blends too. Is there one grape variety you think, you know, if I had to just have one bottle of wine that I've made from one particular grape, what would it be?
It's always going to be Chenin. To answer that in the best possible way, I think Wellington doesn't make it easy. We do have a fantastic climate. We can grow almost anything. And that makes it so difficult. I mean, you have wonderful places like the Himmel and Arda Valley where, yes, you can also grow, I could imagine, almost anything. But it's high risk, high reward, and the most beautiful expressions of a smaller batch of grapes, you know, do so well there that people do focus on them. But in Wellington, it's an open basket. But I think Chenin Blanc has definitely become a very fond love of mine. And then Sinso, as you said, you know, just in terms of the historical inputs here in Wellington and how beautifully it does ripen here, yes. I'm going to be very, that's a very difficult question because all wines that come past our cellar, you know, are given the same amount of respect and love. So I think the long and the short is just giving every batch that we see and touch.
It's like having a favourite child. No, you can't have a favourite child.
It's wrong. Yes.
Yeah. And are there any grapes you don't have? You've got 50, but are there any that you don't have? You think, oh, that could be fun to work with, especially with climate change these days.
Yes. Well, I think we do have quite, you know, mostly what we should have. The only thing that I'm still awaiting is some cuttings of Zarello, which I first tasted in Spain and which I absolutely adored. So that's still on its way. But I mean, the things like Biura and Nero, they've made it to our shores. And in terms of climate change and water scarcity and knowing that the South African viticultural landscape is still quite young, you know, and that it's been governed by grape varieties made famous in different places on the, you know, on the earth, but that we still need something from here, which is going to do that thing for us. I mean, early days. Still looking forward to seeing what we're going to be planting for the future.
Yeah, something from there that isn't Pinotage, perhaps.
Well, you know what, Pinotage, in terms of our export markets, it is hugely important. I think South African winemakers have also done tremendous things in the past few years, getting to grips with, you know, what is actually quite a finicky grape varietal. I think, you know, you're in a cellar, you take the grape bunch of Pinotage and you squeeze it and it's purple ink and it's fabulous. And I think for many years, winemakers thought that, you know what, this is easy peasy. You're just going to, you know, it gives you everything just by looking at it. Even the second day of fermentation in your cellar, you can smell it, it's there, it's fabulous. But I think it's one of those grape varieties that asks a lot in terms of care and guidance on its route into bottle. But I do know that winemakers are making absolute fantastic strides. And let's be honest, it is such a, you know, a young varietal in terms of, you know, history of vine and winemaking that we're getting there, Tim. We're getting there.
Yeah, I think so. And we've talked a little bit about Wellington and why you find it a special place. I mean, I think it'd be fair to say that it's not as famous as some places in the Cape, you know, Stellenbosch or Constantia or Pemlanada you've mentioned. Do you think that gives you greater freedom to innovate and experiment, really, because you're from an area that's slightly less well known?
Yes, I do. There is definitely, here in Wellington, still this idea that we're, you know, an unknown jewel, something that people still need to discover. And in having that and in knowing that when you get to, at the moment we're not traveling, right? But the wonderful thing about traveling in the past was showing people Wellington wines and then with them not having any expectation to over-deliver on that expectation. So I've absolutely loved, you know, giving people these little moments of revelation. And I think Wellington has a lot to discover still, and it's such a wonderful joy to be able to share in that.
Yeah, so you see their faces as they go, oh, Wellington, blimey, this is good.
Yeah, exactly. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, you've said that your favourite grape variety of all is Chenin Blanc, and I don't blame you because I think it's fantastic, yours. Your top wine, Upton Horse, comes from an old vineyard, doesn't it? Well, certainly old for South Africa, which was planted in 1952. Just tell us about the kind of challenges, but also the advantages of working with old vine fruit.
Well, the challenges, luckily, there's a very good understanding of what these parcels are. I think customers have come to realize that, you know, this is something special. This is not something which is going to taste exactly the same year on year. I always, you know, I love Instagram, and I always think that a picture, you know, a wine like Upton Horse is that one Instagram picture that you take in a year, and that's what it is. It's a vintage. It's a story. It's almost, it's the summation of a year's worth of labor into one wine. And that looks different every year. And luckily there's a, you know, people understand that. That's the first thing. The second thing is where we do a lot of work in terms of analysis and making the right decisions for harvesting. That old vine Chenin tells us when it wants to be harvested. It's not something that, you know, looks right on a piece of paper. It's something that you taste and something that you stand in that vineyard and you make the call and you ask the team to come and harvest it the next day. It's definitely a more, it's a journey. It's not something very analytical or something, yes, don't know how to explain that. The other thing is that obviously it is so limited. It's it is what it is because it's old. On the other hand, I've always thought that just because it's old doesn't mean that it's an antique or that it's valuable. It really needs to tell something and show something. And through trial and error, obviously that year it was supposed to be taken out. We took in the grapes for the first time and it proved itself after 3 weeks in tank, in barrel. We were so excited.
And so when was that first vintage?
2007, yes.
So you were thinking of pulling the vineyard out?
This was Petrus Bosman. He's our MD. And luckily for the Bosman family, they're sensible people. So he knew that it was an old vine vineyard. I mean, this was before Ruesa Krier did the research for the Chenin Blanc Association in terms of Chenin vineyard. So we didn't have an idea how old it was. We just knew it was old. But because it had never been made separately, there was no idea of what the quality of the fruit was. And then you could imagine that the yields weren't, you know, hitting up the lights. Mm. So it was one of those vineyards which most probably could have been uprooted. Mm. But Petrus had this feeling of knowing that there's, you know, just this opportunity of maybe looking at it in a better way. We went there that morning. It was brilliant. Made the decision to keep a bit of it separate and look at it. And that was it. Luckily, we kept it.
So it could have gone. Amazing.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the kind of ethical side of the business, the empowerment side, really. I mean, Adama, which is part of the Bosman Adama Group, is a very successful empowerment business. And I just wondered, why do you think it succeeded where others have failed, really? I mean, I think that it's been a very mixed story, the empowerment business in South Africa since 1994.
I think the business has done well because, firstly, this is it's a business that's a long way in the making. It's something that has budded into something beautiful because of, you know, the joint respect and working together of families who actually have been working together more than five generations. Mm-hmm. So I think we should always remember that, let's say, Black empowerment and or reforming your supply chain is not a quick fix, and it's not the same thing for any given business. It's definitely a very personal thing and a very personal way of doing business. The other thing is that the Adama business definitely have a fantastic business model in where they go to their client, they get what the client needs, and then they work it backwards. They put it into the right winery environment, and they go and source the grapes needed for this project. So they're definitely working towards, you know, almost this end product that's needed, and they source it and they make it happen. I think it's amazing that they're also a group of fantastic, dynamic women. I wouldn't say that they're, you know, doing well because they are women, but they have been showing us tremendous things, and it's been wonderful looking at how that business has grown. But I think the long and the short, it is, you know, looking towards the fact that it is a personal expression of what a Black-owned business could look like. It has also a lot to do with mentorship. And yes, this business is doing well because they're definitely servicing their customers, because let's be honest, business is business. And it's important that they do the right things at the right times. And they've been doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I always like visiting Bosman, not just a taste with you, but I think it always feels like a community to me, not just a wine farm. And you've got 300 permanent employees and vineyard workers. And I know what you mean about saying each farm is different and each business is different, but are there things that you can teach other people, maybe good and bad, things that have worked and maybe things that have worked less well?
Well, I think maybe, again, just reiterating the fact that, you know, it's a journey, and it's definitely with input and consultation and taking hands. And, you know, if the core knowledge is that the world can be a better place and that we can have an influence on that, you know, if that's where you start, you know, it comes quite naturally. And I think it has everything to do with the stability. In this business, what we've been able to do is retain the services of fantastic people who year on year have become absolutely specialized in what they do. But it's also because we have diversified the business into being able to do nursery, viticulture, the wine, the marketing of wine, almost the whole supply chain. So it is quite unique. And that's why, again, there isn't a quick fix or a piece of advice, except maybe just the foundation of where this comes from and the willingness from both parties or both sides of the story to make this work and to yes, to keep on keeping on and working at it.
Keep on keeping on. I mean, you've also mentioned that the influence of women. I mean, and I think, I believe I'm right in saying that the Fair Trade Management Committee is all run by women too. I just wonder what has Fair Trade accreditation brought to you guys?
Well, Fair Trade accreditation has brought, if you could imagine, just how many people live and work on our farms. You know, more than 120 families. It is a community, and it has everything to do with, in the end, having a fantastic preschool, having transport for everybody going everywhere. It has everything to do with housing, and then looking at different sections of the community, the old age, you know, the pensioners, and making sure that they're happy and, you know, being, you know, kept busy in a fantastic way. You know, that even if you've left Bosman Adama, that in some way you're still part of a big family. All of these things cost a tremendous amount of money. If you could imagine just the preschool, you know, everybody that's involved. So community and community development is a costly exercise. So what Fairtrade has given us is the opportunity to have a Fairtrade premium, which is then, you know, a premium per liter of wine sold. And every year we're able to tell the Fair Trade Committee what, in terms of our business, they could budget on for these projects and initiatives. And they've been doing a tremendous job in making things work and, you know, allocating funds where it's needed, but also growing it and almost being able to be taking the ownership of that money and making it work for the community in the best possible way. But yes, they've been ladies for the last few years, and I think it's because they know that this is a long-term thing. I mean, you know, if you go alone, you go strong. If you go together, I do think the ladies know how to go together and go far. So they've been inspiring.
Tell us a little bit about the Nero project. We've talked about Chenin Blanc. I think I'm right in saying that this is the only Nero d'Avola in South Africa, isn't it? And it came from Sicily. How did it get from Sicily to Wellington?
It came to Wellington because Petrus Bosman, MD, as I said before, he came back after studying and doing a vintage in the USA. And, you know, there was a lot of people talking about the fact that Wellington was a warm place. I mean, we know it's warm. I mean, it's generous and we've got loads of sunshine. But yes, warmth does also give you, you know, lower acidities and sometimes higher pHs. And we were talking about these things. People were talking about how do we do warmer climate winemaking. So one of these viticulturists then said to Beatrice, but you know what? One could do X, Y, and Z, and it's about canopy management and all of these things, but you could also start planting things that do well in your area. Go to the places that, you know, are more alike. You know, Sicily came up as being one of those places with a climate more applicable, or, you know, to, instead of thinking about things like Merlot or Sauvignon Blanc, you could imagine thinking about Nero in its natural environment where it does so tremendously well, made a lot of sense. So Petrus went to Sicily. He brought back 60 vines, of which only two survived. If you could imagine, this was 2004. And by 2006, after its quarantine period, a small little vineyard was planted. But we were only able in 2013, well, it was a 2013 vintage, which was approved by the Wine and Spirits Board in 2015. It was, you know, it just took a tremendous amount of time to get through the red tape, to get that grape variety.
Well, and amazing, the kind of natural selection process, really, where only two out of the 60 survived.
Oh, my goodness. But they're definitely, they must have been the most beautiful, strongest ones, because I'm looking at those vineyards today, I'm very, very happy for the two that did.
That did, that made it. You've also got an organic range now called Nature and Sun. Do you think South Africa's missing out a little bit on the organic scene? Should it be making more organic wines, given how dry it is, really, as a climate? It's easy to produce organic wines, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think that's what, I mean, if you're into sustainability, you know, it's all about people and planet profit. But I mean, if that planet part, fair trade has also, you know, in a soft way, guided us to having to be much greener. You know, I think people underestimate the amount of effort that actually goes into the environmental side of fair trade. But knowing that we were actually already, you know, making inroads in terms of a softer, greener touch, organic was the next big thing for us. And there's definitely a huge appetite for it. People want to know what they're having, you know, what they're drinking, what they're eating. And in terms of the sustainability and the fact that we can do so much better, I think it's this whole thing about people don't want to drink more, they want to drink better. And better can be a lot of things, but we do feel that organic is definitely almost this low-hanging fruit for South Africa. We should be able to do it. You're right, it is drier. We should be able to champion this. So we're very happy that in 2016 started converting quite a bit of lovely Chenin and some lovely red varietals here in Wellington. So really looking forward to this next chapter.
Yeah. The other thing I want to talk about is I once bumped into you in the street in Burgundy. I think you were zooming past in the morning and waved at me. So you do get to travel outside South Africa. I mean, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, you know, the great grapes of Burgundy. And you now have the chance to make those in a much cooler climate than Wellington, not Burgundy, but in the Hevelinada Valley, don't you, in Hermanus. So just tell us a little bit about how that project developed and what you do there.
Well, this was in 2001. The beautiful farm in the Upper Himalayan Arda Valley was purchased by the family. And it was this knowledge that, you know, these vineyards from where you can see the ocean are so suitable for these beautiful varietals. We do not tend to Sauvignon Blanc in Wellington. You know, we are, you know,
too hot.
Yeah, the family business is viticulture and knowing where things should be planted. So that deep knowledge of, you know what, Sauvignon Blanc, that beautiful Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs, that's going to do tremendously well in that valley. That was the onset. That was the idea of venturing there. The other thing is that it gave us as a company the opportunity to do basically two harvests, if you could imagine. In Wellington, we start so early that, you know, almost by the time we're finished in Wellington, we then switch on into Hermanus and end our harvests there. So, you know, for people who love harvesting, it gave us another opportunity to actually.
So, do you start in Wellington?
Yes, oh, we start very. You know, in 2017 or 16, it was on the 8th of January.
When do you finish in Hermanus?
And at the end of April.
Right, so that's a long time harvesting.
Yes. No, definitely, especially if you wait for Weisse Riesling to get a little bit of noble rot. But yes, it's a long season, but the more harvest we can get from it, the better.
I mean, I just wonder, you're pretty busy, obviously, as we've heard, with all these things that you're doing on the farm. Would you like to make wine overseas, or have you got enough to do where you are?
I think the short answer would be I have enough to do in terms of just the variety of the lovely things that we're busy with. You know, for me, harvesting in Hermanus is almost like, you know, getting my passport ready and going to a different place. I always need to put in a jacket. And if I don't, I'm so cross with myself, because you get, you know, you leave Wellington and it's quite hot and you get to Hermanus, and in the, you know, afternoon, you know, the mist comes rolling in and it's cool. It's really cold. So I always tell myself that I actually do two harvests a year in any way, in two very inspiring places. So I'm quite happy for it.
Is there anywhere you'd like to make wine? You know, let's just dream for a second.
Well, obviously, in terms of the beautiful people and the network of people that I've met in the Loire, you know, the likes of the Karems, Vincent and Tanya, and Evelyn de Pontebriand, the fact that I could imagine myself having them as mentors, wanting to do something in the Loire, but basically just to see, you know, the whole thing about terroir, where we say it's this place, it's the grapes, all of these things, but that human element, what does that imply if you take a South African winemaker and you stuck her in the Loire? I don't know.
With Chenin Blanc.
Yes, with Chenin Blanc. But yes, so maybe one day as a pet project, but at the moment really just enjoying buying out the amount of time that I do have, you know, with what we have at hand.
Yeah. I mean, how do you get away from wine? I mean, you have got a very big job in many ways. You've also got a family. You know, is wine all consuming, or are you one of these very outdoor South Africans who likes to go off hiking and playing sport and stuff like that? How do you get away from it?
Well, I think the long and the short is that because we're in the winelands, wine does follow me everywhere. So even though it's trail running or walking, it's always in these beautiful mountains from where you can see these lovely vineyards. The other thing is that food follows me everywhere, because I think food and wine, you know, is just the most wonderful thing about our industry as well. The fact that these things so sublimely come together, and that we really do enjoy that. But I think my biggest focus is family. I do spend a lot of time in harvest time away from them, and also throughout the year. So when I'm there, I try to be fully there. But now I have a 16-year-old daughter who also has her little crystal glass and actually is quite good at tasting, looking and smelling.
So, the next generation of Furry winemakers is already settled, is it?
Oh, man. I can't imagine that she might become a winemaker, but I would love for her to have this wonderful thing, which is, you know, the community of wine. And there's just this very special thing that it brings, almost like art. You know, it is enriching. So I do hope, and I hope that for her, that she'll experience that and also enjoy that.
What's her name, just so we know? We can watch out for her in 10 years' time.
Oh, my goodness. It's a Dutch name, so I'm going to be very sorry if you can't pronounce it, but it's Nalika. So Nalika
Furie. Nalika Furie, right. Perfect. Remember that name, everybody. She's got two amazing parents who are both winemakers.
Oh.
In 10 years' time, she'll be the next winemaker.
Oh, brilliant.
Making a noise in South Africa. Could be before that. She could be 21.
Oh,
five,
you know,
years
what?
Time. So.
I could imagine her might, you know, going into either food or being a sommelier or, yes. But definitely we'll have her tasting good wines in the meantime.
Fantastic. Listen, Kulia, it's been fantastic talking to you as ever. Love what you're doing at Bosman. It's really inspiring in many ways. See you soon, I hope.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you, Tim.
What an inspiring person Kulia is. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Eddie Del Popolo from Perse in Argentina. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.